When she hit her 60s, the Cambridge-based writer Gail Caldwell says she was offered a new chapter to an old story. And she asks, what do you do when the story changes in midlife, as it did for her in a big way?
Gail Caldwell is the Pulitzer Prize-winning former chief book critic of the Boston Globe. And we're going to revisit a conversation we had with her last summer about her memoir, New Life, No Instructions. In it, Caldwell reflects on her childhood in Armadillo, Texas, her battle with alcoholism and the losses of her mother, her best friend, and her sled dog, Clementine.
She also writes about how childhood polio and a lifelong limp became part of the story that defined her. But decades later, hip replacement surgery not only relieved the crippling pain, it gave her life a whole new narrative.
How did the polio sort of shape the narrative of your life?
When I first started this book, I was in the midst of raising an intractable young sled dog, the next one, the next generation after Clementine, and I, for some reason, was catapulted back in time to my mother when I was an infant and a little girl trying to help me recover from polio, partly because I think I was so conscious of the braid of attachment and duty that parental or family obligation, if you will, is part of the species. And the more I thought about that and about my mom and about what was happening to me, I also began being really tested by the wild energy.
This is a 50-pound Samoyed,
50,
right?
50, now 56-pound.
56-pound
Samoyed. And she's bred to pull 1,000 pounds. So right. I also didn't realize what was happening to me, of course. And I'm not really answering your question about the polio and how it defined me. I think I spent a lot of time in my life trying to have it not define me in any way, shape, or form. Mm. That was certainly true in childhood and adolescence. And then by the time I had toughed my way into a new self-image, it was something I just as soon forget about.
So you use this word that, and I wanted to ask you about this. You use the word toughed yourself into a new self-image. Did it make you tough in a way?
You know, we can always look back and go, well, I suspect it did. Mm-hmm. But what else? I mean, did the water in Texas make me tough? Did the whole macho image of growing up in the panhandle make me tough? I do remember trying to walk and not being able to. I still have dreams about that, even though I was probably somewhere between 1 and 2 when that frustration occurred. So I have a sense of effort and effort and effort and to keep on going. Yeah. That's very deep and sort of pre-verbal, and I expect that's somewhere deep in my character map.
Well, so this amazing thing happens to you when you write about this. So as you enter your 60s, you're dealing with increasingly debilitating pain, and you end up going to a doctor here in Boston who suggests, well, let's, I don't know if he said X-ray or MRI, but he wants to understand what's going on in your leg. And you'd never had an X-ray or an MRI.
Right. The interesting thing to me now, in retrospect, is that I always went into all my medical appointments as though it was my duty to tell them what was wrong with me. I mean, maybe we all do this. Hi, I have a pain in my upper right molar. Hi, I think I'm losing my mind. Whatever it is. But I would always go in and say to orthopedic surgeons and everybody else, I had polio when I was 6 months old. It's affected my back, my spine, blah, blah, blah. And so I went in and gave him the narrative, and he watched me walk, and he ignored what I had to tell him. He said, this polio explains the weakness but not the pain. It's a neurological disease. There should be no after effect of pain. What does the MRI show? And I said, what MRI? So what I really love about that moment, even though I really admire him as a physician, what I most admire is his refusal to let me do his job. You know, he totally was uninterested in what
amazing,
I thought was happening.
It's amazing to me that so many doctors before him apparently did let you do their job.
I think that polio is this great mystery to so many people, and it's also over, so it's not, and it's one of the things that actually compelled me to write this book. I'm so conscious, and I've heard from so many people since the book came out, people that have survived polio or remember the epidemics and how terrifying they were.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 1951, the year I was born, and the vaccines came out and were administered, I think, began in 55. And the people who are left are my age or older. So I suspect that the medical profession, and I know the physical therapy and physical training profession, you can walk into any gym or PT office and you say polio and they're like,
right.
Oh, it's like cholera, right? You know, it's this just medieval
mystery. Just impossible
mystery.
To imagine, yeah. Well, so this wonderful doctor has you do an MRI and discovers that essentially for the last decade or so, you've been walking on a non-existent hip.
Right.
More or less. Right.
Yeah, as a friend of mine called it, walking on memory and prayer. You know, there was not much else there. Yeah.
So you have full hip replacement surgery. It goes well, but I appreciated how you wrote about this because I remember watching my now late dad go through hip replacement surgery, and everyone said, oh, this is going to be great. You're going to be playing tennis, you know, 15 minutes later. I think that's the term you used, you know. Right. But it turns out not so straightforward, although it does allow you to sort of redefine part of this story about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
How high you stand, how you walk, what else?
Well, I think you're right. I think maybe we do this with all kinds of, the more common something is, the more we tend to sort of assume it's going to be a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Oh, pregnancy, no big deal. You'll come home with your bundle of joy. You know, I mean, there are so many ways that we can simplify the facts simply because they're ordinary. And ordinary really has nothing to do with difficulty, I think. Mm. For me, it was life-changing because I had, psychological, I had thought that there was nothing to be done. And I had been carrying that thought in private for about a decade while I watched things get worse and worse and worse. And the idea that there was ever something that I could do beyond what I had been doing, which was to hurl myself into the pool or into a boat. I mean, I've always been really stubborn, so I'm a really mediocre but determined athlete.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's gotten me certain places but only so far. And the idea that you could kind of let go of the rope and there would be a solution that somebody else brought you, it was a huge exercise in trust for me. And I think humbling because you don't expect things to change that much after a certain point in life. It's easy to, I mean, I said to a friend who's about my age, and we're talking about her young, beautiful daughter on the verge of a brilliant career in acting. And I said, and we were talking about midlife, and I said, there comes a point in life when you trade in hope for planning. and then I thought, oh my God, that sounds so despairing. But I do think it's true because you're on this certain hill and you know that there are certain things that are not going to be any different from what they were.
I think that was what was so profound about your story and the way you wrote it is this idea that I think you phrase it well, the narrative can always turn out to be a different story from what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like we shut down the possibility of that happening after a certain point in our lives, if we're unlucky. But maybe that's more common than it should be.
I think we do it every day. I was actually, I mean, not all of us, but I was thinking about this coming over here because I was thinking about the way, you know, you can get, at the end of the day, you can go, oh my God, I had an exhausting day. Whatever it was, somebody yelled at me in traffic. I almost fell down the stairs, blah, blah, blah. Or you can turn it around and say, I have a friend who used to always wake up and she'd tell her story at the end of the day and she'd say, first, I got up. Mm. And then you knew the narrative was going to go any number of ways. So, I mean, I think we do that with our whole lives. And as a writer, I've always wanted to test, to find the limits of the wall of my own consciousness, because I think that what we think the story is a very limiting way to live.
Mm, I think that's really profound. I want to ask you about, there's so much in this book that I'd love to ask you about, the importance of these animals to you. You've had a lot of animals. The star animal of this story is Tula, the 55-pound Samoyed. But you... there's a moment in the book, I'm just going to read, it's a very short paragraph. Chris, Calliope, Kachina, Amarina, Boofer, Ellie, Rima, Lucky, Corey, Rex, Dashiell, Annie, Barley, Lucille, Cleo, Clementine, Shiloh, Tula. Great names, by the way. These are some of the animals that have made my heart wider and wider, all of them a one-way street to mercy, the totems through which we reach ourselves.
Mm.
I love that. I love that. But I want you to talk more about, I want to ask you more about what these animals have meant to you in your life.
Oh my God, I think they've meant everything in so many ways. I I remember saying to my friend Caroline Knapp, who you mentioned in the beginning, Caroline and I fell in love with each other through our dogs. And I remember once describing the idea of going through a sort of young motherhood with puppies. And I said that it was about the color of joy. And I feel that that is, has been, that the dogs in my life have been a way of giving me not just companionship, but they teach me so much about trust and forgiveness and moving forward.
They don't hold on to grudges, do they?
They don't hold on to grudges. They don't. And it's amazing to me. They don't hold on to their own sense of limitations, or and they have no sense of failure. If it doesn't work, they go around.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're a great exercise in bravery and love for me.
So Tula guided you in many ways through this journey. You told my producer, Jamie Bologna, that she's now herself recovering from surgery.
Oh, my God. I came down here because I left my girl at home in an inflatable collar and stitches in her leg. And she's undergone it. It's a very simple ligament repair for an athletic dog. But the funny thing is we're doing rehab that's almost identical to mine.
Wow.
Except that she's not using my crutches. Otherwise, she has me as a physical therapist.
And how's she doing?
She's doing great. Like I said, she has no sense of anticipation. She has no sense of misery. She's just like, when are we going to get to run in the woods again?
That's nice.
I wish I could have been so brave after my own surgery.
Dogs don't bring any self-pity, do
None.
They, to these kinds of missions. And how are you doing? Because we should, for folks who haven't yet read this, I mean, you're a rower, you're a swimmer. I mean, I got a workout reading your book, just imagining all the exercise that you do. But how are you doing now, just in terms of where you want it to be, in terms of coming back after this total hip replacement?
Well, I suppose it's part of my insanely driven personality that I am, of course, not where I want to be. I think I'm partly lazy and partly driven, which is a lethal combination. Mm-hmm. I am rowing. I am swimming. I'm walking not as fast or as well, but I think I'm probably better than I really thought I'd ever be again. And I did write at the end of the book that I the fact of that change had to trump how hard it has been. I think, you know, one of the things I think, and I've heard from some people who had polio, who are often, by the way, discouraged from having joint replacement surgery because they say the rehab is so hard that they can't do it. And I know I have met some people through this book who have just undergone it and have said they feel like that it changed their lives.
Yeah.
So that's a huge relief, and I think you have to take you have to take success in whatever dosage it's handed to you.
Tell me about the title, New Life, No Instructions. Aren't we all going through our own lives, in a sense, with no instructions?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Except for the ones that, you know, we make up as we go along and that society inflicts upon us. When I wrote that line, it's actually from the beginning of the book when I said I was thinking about the pilgrims who make their way to Fatima and Lourdes, and that I wondered if, in fact, they ever question the miracle. Because the line actually came from a very skeptical moment when I was thinking about this, which is, you know, that you get, somebody says, we're going to change your life. Here, your life has changed. Now, go home. But you're still you.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, so what do I do now?
Yeah.
Yes, I think we all stagger forth with no instructions, and often the best things we learn in life are when we have no rule book.
I agree. Just be open to the possibility that the story can change if we let it.
Mm-hmm.
Gail Caldwell, she's the Cambridge-based author of the new memoir, New Life, No Instructions. Gail, thanks so much for coming in, and thank you for the book. It is really lovely. I recommend it.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
That was author Gail Caldwell speaking to Anthony last summer. There's more information about her memoir at radioboston.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.